Others are tapped for politics and Congress, and some are chosen to stay behind and teach. But Drake is the Republic's best university, and seeing as how the best are always assigned into the military, our drill room is packed with students. By the time we reach one of Drake's outer streets, and I climb into the back seat of our waiting military jeep, Mateus can barely contain his anger. "Suspended for a week? Do you want to explain this to me?" he demands. "I get back from a morning of dealing with the Patriot rebels, and what do I hear about? Helicopters 2 blocks from Drake? A girl scaling a skyscraper?" I exchange a friendly look with Thomas, the soldier in the driver's seat. "Sorry," I mutter. Mateus turns around from his place in the passenger seat and narrows his eyes at me. "What the hell were you thinking? Did you know you'd wandered right off campus?"
"Yes."
"Of course. You're 15. You went 14 floors up a..." He takes a deep breath, closes his eyes, and steadies himself. "For once, I'd appreciate it if you would let me do my daily tours of duty without worrying myself sick over what you're up to." I try to meet Thomas's eyes again in the rearview mirror, but he keeps his gaze on the road. Of course, I shouldn't expect any help from him. He looks as tidy as ever, with his perfectly slicked hair and perfectly ironed uniform. Not a strand or thread out of place. Thomas might be several years younger than Mateus and a subordinate on his patrol, but he's more disciplined than anyone I know. Sometimes I wish I had that much discipline. He probably disapproves of my stunts, even more than Mateus does. We leave downtown Los Angeles behind and travel up the winding highway in silence. The scenery changes from the inner Batalha sector's 100-floor skyscrapers to densely packed barrack towers and civilian complexes, each one only 20 to 30 stories high, with red guiding lights blinking on their roofs, most with all their paint stripped off after this year's rash of storms. Metal support beams crisscross their walls. I hope they get to upgrade those supports soon. The war's been intense lately, and with several decades of infrastructure funding diverted to supplying the warfront, I don't know if these buildings would hold up well in another earthquake. After a few minutes, Mateus continues in a calmer voice. "You really scared me today," he says. "I was afraid they'd mistake you for Day and shoot at you." I know he doesn't mean this as a compliment, but I can't help smiling. I lean forward to rest my arms on the top of his seat. "Hey," I say, tugging his ear the way I did when I was a kid. "I'm sorry I made you worry." He lets out a scornful chuckle, but I can tell his anger is already fading. "Yeah, that's what you say every time, Junebug. Is Drake not keeping your brain busy enough? If not, then I don't know what will." "You know, if you'd just take me along on some of your missions, I'd probably learn a lot more and stay out of trouble." "Nice try. You're not going anywhere until you graduate and get assigned to your own patrol." I bite my tongue. Mateus did pick me once, for a mission last year, when all third-year Drake students had to shadow an assigned military branch. His commander sent him to kill a runaway prisoner of war from the colonies. So Mateus brought me along with him, and together we chased the POW deeper and deeper into our territory, away from the dividing fences in the strip of land running from Dakota to West Texas that separates the Republic and the colonies. Away from the waterfront where airships dot the sky. I tracked him into an alley in Yellowstone City, Montana, and Mateus shot him. During the chase, I broke 3 ribs and had a knife buried in my leg. Now Mateus refuses to take me anywhere. When Mateus finally speaks again, he sounds grudgingly curious. "So, tell me," he whispers, "how fast did you climb those 14 stories?" Thomas makes a disapproving sound in his throat, but I break into a grin. Storms passed. Mateus loves me again. 6 minutes, I whisper back to my brother, and 44 seconds. How do you like that? That must be some sort of record. Not that, you know, you're supposed to do it. Thomas stops the jeep right behind the lines at a red light and gives Mateus an exasperated look. "Come on, Captain," he says. Ms. Iparis won't learn a thing if you keep praising her for breaking the rules." "Cheer up, Thomas." Mateus reaches over and claps him on the back. Surely breaking a rule once in a while is tolerable, especially if you're doing it to beef up your skills for the Republic's sake. Victory against the colonies, right? The light blinks green. Thomas turns his eyes back to the road. He seems to count to three in his head before letting the jeep go forward. Right, he mutters. You should still be careful what you're encouraging Miss Paris to do, especially with your parents gone. Mateus's mouth tightens into a line, and a familiar, strained look appears in his eyes. No matter how sharp my intuition is, no matter how well I do at Drake, or how perfectly I score in defense and target practice and hand-to-hand combat, Mateus's eyes always hold that fear. He's afraid something might happen to me one day, like the car crash that took our parents. That fear never leaves his face, and Thomas knows it. I didn't know our parents long enough to miss them in the same way Mateus does. Whenever I cry over losing them, I cry because I don't have any memories of them. Just hazy recollections of long, adult legs shuffling around our apartment and hands lifting me from my high chair. That's it. Every other memory from my childhood, looking out into the auditorium as I receive an award, or having soup made for me when I'm sick, or being scolded, or tucked into bed, those are with Mateus. We drive past half of Batala sector and through a few poor blocks. Can't these street beggars stay a little further from our jeep? Finally, we reach the gleaming, terraced high-rises of Ruby, and we're home. Mateus gets out first. As I follow, Thomas gives me a small smile. See you later, Miss Paris, he says, tipping his hat. I stop trying to convince him to call me June. He'll never change. Still, it's not so bad being called something proper. Maybe when I'm older, and Mateus doesn't faint at the idea of me dating. Bye, Thomas. Thanks for the ride. I smile back at him before stepping out of the jeep. Mateus waits until the door has slammed shut before turning to me and lowering his voice. I'll be home late tonight, he says. There's that tension in his eyes again. Don't go out alone. News from the war front is they're cutting power to the residences tonight to save energy for the airfield bases. So stay put, okay? The streets will be darker than usual. My heart sinks. I wish the Republic would hurry up and win this war already, so that for once we might actually get a whole month of non-stop electricity. Where are you going? Can I come with you? I'm overseeing the lab at Los Angeles Central. They're delivering vials of some mutated virus there. It shouldn't take all night. And I already told you no. No missions. Mateus hesitates. I'll be home as early as I can. We have a lot to talk about. He puts his hands on my shoulders, ignores my puzzled look, and gives me a quick kiss on my forehead. Love you, Junebug, he says, his trademark goodbye. He turns to climb back into the jeep. I'm not going to wait up for you, I call after him. But by now he's already inside, and the jeep's pulling away with him inside of it. Be careful, I murmur. But it's pointless to say now. Mateus is too far away to hear me.
Day. When I was 7 years old, my father came home from the war front for a week's leave. His job was to clean up after the Republic soldiers, so he was usually gone, and Mom was left to raise us boys on her own. When he came home that time, the city patrols did a routine inspection of our house, then dragged Dad off to the local police headquarters for questioning. They'd found something suspicious, I guess. The police brought him back with two broken arms, his face bloody and bruised. Several nights later, I dipped a ball of crushed ice into a can of gasoline, let the oil harden into a crisp shell around the ice, and lit it. Then I launched it with a slingshot through the window of our local police headquarters. I remember the fire trucks that came whizzing around the corner shortly thereafter, and the charred remains of the police building's west wing. They never found out who did it, and I never came forward. There was, after all, no evidence. I had committed my first perfect crime. My mother used to hope that I would rise up from my humble roots, become someone successful, or even famous. I'm famous, all right, but I don't think it's what she had in mind. It's nightfall again, a good 48 hours since the soldiers marked my mother's door. I wait in the shadows of a back alley one block from the Los Angeles Central Hospital and watch its staff spill in and out of the main entrance. It's a cloudy night, with no moon, and I can't even make out the crumbling bank tower sign at the top of the building. Electric lights shine from each floor, a luxury only government buildings and the elite's homes can afford. Military jeeps stack up along the street as they wait for approval to enter the underground parking lots. Someone checks them for proper IDs. I keep still, my eyes fixed on the entrance. I look pretty awesome tonight. I'm wearing my good pair of shoes, boots made of dark leather worn soft over time, with strong laces and steel toes. Bought them with 150 notes from our stash. I've hidden a knife flat against the sole of each boot. When I shift my feet, I can feel the cool metal against my skin. My black trousers are tucked into my boots, and I carry a pair of gloves and a black handkerchief in my pockets. A dark long-sleeve shirt is tied around my waist. My hair hangs loose down my shoulders. This time I've sprayed my white blonde strands a deep black, as if I'd dipped them in crude oil. Earlier in the day, Tess had traded 5 notes for a bucket of pygmy pig's blood from the back alley of a kitchen. My arms, stomach, and face are smeared with it. I've also streaked mud on my cheeks, for good measure. The hospital spans the first 12 floors of the building, but I'm only interested in the one without windows. That's the 3rd floor, a laboratory where the blood samples and medicines will be. From the outside, the 3rd floor is completely hidden behind elaborate stone carvings and worn Republic flags. Behind the facade lies a vast floor with no halls and no doors. Just a gigantic room, doctors and nurses behind white masks, test tubes and pipettes, incubators and gurneys. I know this because I've been there before. I was there the day I failed my trial, the day I was supposed to die. My eyes scan the side of the tower. Sometimes I can break into a building by running it from the outside, if there are balconies to leap from and window ledges to balance on. I once scaled a 4-story building in less than 5 seconds. But this tower is too smooth, with no footholds. I'll have to reach the lab from inside. I shiver a little even in the warmth, and wish I'd asked Tess to come with me. But 2 trespassers are easier to catch than 1. Besides, it's not her family who needs medicine. I check to make sure I've tucked my pendant beneath my shirt. A lone medic truck pulls up behind the military jeeps. Several soldiers climb out and greet the nurses while others unpack the truck's boxes. The leader of the group is a young, dark-haired man dressed all in black, except for 2 rows of silver buttons that line his officer jacket. I strain to hear what he's saying to one of the nurses. From around the lake's edge, the man tightens his gloves. I catch a glimpse of the gun at his belt. My men will be at the entrances tonight.
Yes, Captain, the nurse says.
The man tips his cap to her. My name's Mateus. If you have any questions, come see me. I wait until the soldiers have spread out around the hospital's perimeter, and the man named Mateus has immersed himself in conversation with 2 of his men. Several more medic trucks come and go, dropping off soldiers, some with broken limbs, some with gashes on their heads or lacerations on their legs. I take a deep breath, then step out of the shadows and stumble toward the hospital's entrance. A nurse spots me first, just outside the main doors. Her eyes dart to the blood on my arms and face.
Can I be admitted, cousin? I call to her.
I wince in imaginary pain.
Is there still room tonight? I can pay.
She looks at me without pity before she returns to scribbling on a notepad. Guess she doesn't appreciate the cousin affection. An ID tag dangles from her neck.
What happened? She asks.
I double over when I reach her and lean on my knees.
Was in a fight,
I say, panting.
I think I got stabbed.
The nurse doesn't look at me again. She finishes writing and then nods at one of the guards.
Pat him down.
I stay where I am as 2 soldiers check me for weapons. I yelp on cue when they touch my arms or stomach. They don't find the knives tucked in my boots. They do take the little pouch of notes tied to my belt. My payment for entering the hospital. Of course. If I was a gaudy rich sector boy, I'd be admitted without charge. Or they'd send a doctor for free straight up to where I live. When the soldiers give the nurse a thumbs up, she points me toward the entrance.
Waiting room's on the left. Have a seat.
I thank her and stumble toward the sliding doors. The man named Mateus watches me as I pass. He's listening patiently to one of his soldiers, but I see him study my face as if out of habit. I make a mental note of his face, too. The hospital is ghostly white on the inside. To my left, I see the waiting room, just like the nurse said. A huge space packed with people sporting injuries of all shapes and sizes. Many of them moan in pain. One person lies unmoving on the floor. I don't want to guess how long some of them have been here, or how much they had to pay to get in. I note where all the soldiers are standing. Two by the secretary's window, two by the doctor's door far in the distance, several near the elevators, each wearing ID tags. And then I drop my eyes to the floor. I shuffle to the closest chair and sit. For once, my bad knee helps my disguise. I keep my hands pressed against my side for good measure. I count 10 minutes off in my head, long enough so that new patients have arrived in the waiting room and the soldiers are less interested in me. Then I stand up, pretend to stumble, and lurch toward the closest soldier. His hand reflexively moves to his gun. "Sit back down," he says. I trip and fall against him.
"I need the bathroom," I whisper,
my voice hoarse. My hands tremble as I grab his black robes for balance. The soldier looks at me in disgust while some of the others snicker. I see his fingers creep closer to his gun's trigger, but one of the other soldiers shakes his head. No shooting in the hospital. The soldier pushes me away and points toward the end of the hall with his gun. "Over there," he snaps. "Wipe some of that filth off your face, and if you touch me again, I'll fill you with bullets." I release him and nearly fall to my knees. Then I turn and stagger toward the restroom. My leather boots squeak against the floor tiles. I can feel the soldier's eyes on me as I enter the bathroom and lock the door. No matter. They'll forget about me in a couple of minutes, and it'll take several more minutes before the soldier I'd grabbed realizes that his ID tag is missing. Once in the bathroom, I abandon my sick routine. I splash water on my face and scrub until most of the pig's blood and mud have come off. I unzip my boots and tear open the inner soles to reveal my knives, then tuck them into my belt. My boots go back on my feet. Then I untie the black-collared shirt from around my waist and put it on, buttoning it up all the way to my neck and clipping my suspenders over it. I pull my hair back into a tight ponytail and tuck the tail into the shirt so it's pressed flat against my back. Finally, I pull my gloves on and tie a black handkerchief around my mouth and nose. If someone catches me now, I'll be forced to run anyway. Might as well hide my face. When I finish, I use the tip of one of my knives to unscrew the cover to the bathroom's ventilation shaft. Then I take out the soldier's ID tag, clip it to my pendant necklace, and stuff myself headfirst into the shaft's tunnel. The air in the shaft smells strange, and I'm grateful for the handkerchief around my face. I inch along as fast as I can. The shaft can't be more than 2 feet wide in any direction. Each time I pull myself forward, I have to close my eyes and remind myself to breathe, that the metal walls around me are not closing in. I don't have to go far. None of these shafts will lead to the fourth floor. I only need to get far enough to pop out into one of the hospital's stairwells, away from the soldiers on the first floor. I press forward. I think of Eden's face, of the medicine he and John and my mother will need, and of the strange X with the line through it. After several minutes, the shaft dead ends. I look through the vent, and in the slivers of light, I can see pieces of a curved stairwell. The floor is an immaculate white, almost beautiful, and, most important, empty. I count to three in my head, then bring my arms as far back as I can and give the shaft cover a mighty shove. The cover flies off. I get one good glimpse of the stairwell, a large cylindrical chamber with tall plaster walls and tiny windows. One enormous, spiraling set of stairs. Now I'm moving with all speed and no stealth. Run it! I squeeze out of the shaft and dart up the steps. Halfway up, I grab the railing and fling myself to the next highest curve. The security cameras must be focused on me. An alarm will sound any minute now. Second floor, third floor. I'm running out of time. As I approach the third floor door, I tear the ID tag off my necklace and pause long enough to swipe it against the door's reader. The security cameras haven't triggered an alarm in time to lock down the stairwell. The handle clicks. I'm in. I throw open the door. I'm in a huge room filled with rows of gurneys and chemicals boiling under metal hoods. Doctors and soldiers look up at me with startled faces. I grab the first person I see, a young doctor standing close to the door. Before any of the soldiers can point a gun in our direction, I whip out one of my knives and hold it close to the man's throat. The other doctors and nurses freeze. Several of them scream. "Shoot and you'll hit him instead!" I call out to the soldiers from beneath my handkerchief. Their guns are focused on me now. The doctor trembles in my grasp. I press my knife harder against his neck, careful not to cut him. I won't hurt you, I whisper in his ear. Tell me where to get the plague cures. He lets out a strangled whimper, and I can feel him sweating under my grip. He gestures toward the refrigerators. The soldiers are still hesitating, but one of them calls out to me.
Release the doctor! He shouts. Put your hands up!
I want to laugh. The soldier must be a new recruit. I cross the room with the doctor and stop at the refrigerators. Show me. The doctor lifts a trembling hand and pulls the fridge door open. A gust of freezing air hits us. I wonder if the doctor can feel how fast my heart is beating.
There,
he whispers. I turn away from the soldiers long enough to see the doctor pointing at the top shelf in the fridge. Half of the vials on the shelf are labeled with a three-lined X. T. Filoviridae virus mutations. The other half of the vials are labeled 11.30 cures. But all of the vials are empty. They've run out. I curse under my breath. My eyes skim other shelves. They only have plague suppressants and various painkillers. I curse again. Too late to turn back now. I'm letting go, I whisper to the doctor. Duck. I release my grip and shove him hard enough to make him fall to his knees. The soldiers open fire, but I'm ready for them. I hide behind the open fridge door as bullets ricochet off it. I grab several bottles of suppressants and shove them into my shirt. I bolt. One of the stray bullets scrapes me and searing pain shoots up my arm. I'm almost at the exit. An alarm goes off as I burst through the stairwell door. There's a chorus of clicks as all the doors in the stairwell lock from the inside. I'm trapped. The soldiers can still come through any door, but I won't be able to get out. Shouts and footsteps echo from inside the laboratory. A voice yells out, "He's hit!" My eyes jump to the tiny windows in the stairwell's plaster walls. They're too far away for me to reach from the stairs themselves. I grit my teeth and pull out my second knife so that I now have one in each hand. I pray the plaster is soft enough, then leap off the stairs and throw myself toward the wall. I stab one knife straight into the plaster. My wounded arm gushes blood and I scream from the effort. I'm dangling halfway between my launching place and the window. I rock back and forth as hard as I can. The plaster is giving way. Behind me I hear the laboratory door burst open and soldiers spill out. Bullets spark all around me. I swing toward the window and let go of the knife buried in the wall. The window shatters and I'm suddenly out in the night again and falling, falling, falling like a star to the first floor. I rip open my long-sleeve shirt and let it billow out behind me as thoughts zip through my head. Knees bent. Feet first. Relax muscles. Hit with balls of feet. Roll. The ground rushes up at me. I brace myself. The impact knocks the wind out of me. I roll four times and crash into the wall on the other side of the street. For a moment, I lie there blinded, completely helpless. Above me, I can hear furious voices coming from the third-floor window as the soldiers realize they're going to have to double back into the laboratory to disable the alarm. My senses gradually sharpen. Now I'm very aware of the pain in my side and arm.